Hello and welcome to everybody here in the SEC auditorium, and most importantly to everybody listening to us online at www.sechistorical.org. My name is David Martin, and I am the 2008-2009 President of the Board of Trustees of the SEC Historical Society. And I would like to welcome you on behalf of the Board of Trustees and extend a sincere welcome to this, our ninth annual meeting. Before we start our meeting, I'd like to say a word of thanks to the SEC and a brief introduction regarding our society. We are completely independent of the government, receive no government funding, and are not connected to the SEC in any legal way, but our Board of Trustees deeply appreciates the friendship and the hospitality that the SEC has extended to us for these programs and really through the life of our society and our mission. Particularly, we would like to say thank you to SEC Chairman Christopher Cox, who has been a big supporter, come to many of our events, and has been very helpful in having our programs be extended to the SEC throughout the country. I'd also like to say a congratulations to some of our volunteer leaders who are being called to a higher order, if you will. Elise Walter from our Board of Trustees was sat in confirmation hearings earlier this week, along with Troy Parides, who is a member of our Museum Committee, and they will soon, they're preparing now to become commissioners of the SEC. Let me say a word about the Society. Our mission is to preserve and share the history of the SEC and the securities industry, and we do this mostly through our virtual museum, which many of you are on right now, and I hope you'll continue to participate in our museum 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We get over 10,000 visitors every month, and the museum is growing before our eyes. We also do many programs, and this is one of them. This is the beginning of we are in the midst of an exciting period for us and for the SEC, because we are in the midst of really a celebration of the SEC's 75th anniversary. We started this in November with a whole series of programs. This particular program is one in a series devoted to the works of the major divisions of the SEC. This series began in November of 2007 with our program entitled Keeping the Markets Open, Lessons Learned from the 1987 Market Break. And this was on what was then known as the Division of Market Regulation. Since that time, we have had fireside chats on the Office of the General Counsel, the Office of International Affairs, and on the regional offices. We will, after this program, pick up in the fall of 2009 with programs on the Division of Enforcement, the Office of Compliance, Inspections, and Examinations, the Division of Corporation Finance, the Office of the Chief Accountant, and the Office of the Chairman. And this commemoration march, if you will culminate next June with our 10th annual meeting here in this building with a program entitled Let's Not Take the SEC for Granted, and finally with a 75th anniversary gala dinner on June the 25th, 2009. Let me say also, as part of this commemoration year, the Society has been able to celebrate with the SEC across the country. We have had ice cream socials at this point in Atlanta, Boston, and Denver. We'll be in Philadelphia later this month, and we intend to visit all the regional offices. And, of course, today, for those of you that are here at our ninth anniversary, or our ninth annual meeting, there'll be an ice cream social following this. And so a word of thanks really to our trustees, our advisors, our donors, our sponsors, our supporters everywhere for making all of what we are doing possible and for being here today with us. And now let me start with today's program, Exemptive Authority, the Mandate of the Division of Investment Management. And I have to say that we couldn't be luckier to have a chair and moderator of the ilk of Martin Liebecker of the firm Wilmer, Cutler, Pickering, Hale, and Dorr, and also a member of our Board of Advisors. I think most of you know that Marty is really a true luminary in the 40 Act bar. He has really a deep history and deep experience in this area, which include 25 years or more of private practice, a number of years here at the SEC in service, including as an associate director. And Marty has been a professor and taught at a number of law schools, including Georgetown and Duke and the University of North Carolina. So we are really in very, very good hands, and I would like now, if I could, to turn over the rest of the program and raise the curtain on this program by introducing Marty Leibecker to you. And Marty, then you could perhaps introduce your distinguished panel.
Thank you, David. I'm pleased to welcome you all today to the program on the work of the Division of Investment Management. It was our choice to focus on exemptive authority because it's one of the really unique aspects of the division, and as I'll explain. I need to thank Bob Place, who's sitting to my left, who's an associate director in the division, for all of his help in planning this program and making it come together. I also need to thank Ken Berman, who's to my immediate right, of Debevoise and Plimpton, and Kathleen Moriarty of Catton Munchen, who's to my far right, for joining us and sharing their experiences and their expertise. As is typical in things that relate to the SEC, before we begin our discussion, I would like to state that the comments we make today are solely our own, are not representative of the SEC Historical Society or of the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, and I am also required to say our speakers cannot give legal or investment advice. I'm not sure quite why I have to say that, but we've said it. Okay. The premise of this program is that beyond the actual prohibitions and the investor protections that are written into the Investment Company Act, the genius of this statute is that the draftsman inserted exemptive authority in various provisions of the Act. And I think it's fair to say that without that exemptive authority, the Investment Company Act would have become irrelevant, or at least the investment company industry would have been irrelevant by 1960 or 1970. Instead, we find that we've got a vibrant investment management industry. Investors enjoy access to variable annuities, money market funds, multiple classes, wrap accounts, funds of funds, ETFs, all of which wouldn't have happened without exemptive authority, and they have the opportunity to pay fees for services in a variety of ways. So the first premise is that exemptive authority is unique, and it was to all the divisions until very recently. The second premise is that in administering the Investment Company Act, both the commission and the staff have been shaped in the way they've dealt with issues by the fact that they had that kind of exemptive authority. There is no other division or office that over the history of the commission has always had that kind of tool. So from my perspective, it's always made working with and being involved in the division's affairs quite a unique experience for being an employee of the commission. I thank David for his kind remarks. I'm pretty sure the only reason I'm here is because I am one of the few people in this room who probably actually worked at 500 North Capitol Street. The rest of you started at 450 Fifth Street. And I actually know people who worked, when I was on the staff, knew people who'd worked at the SEC offices on E Street. Some of you don't even know they had offices there then after World War II. And we all know some people who actually worked in the SEC's office in Philadelphia. I'm sure that's, if you live long enough, I guess you can say things like that. Okay. We've divided this up into six big topics, and I'll tell you who everybody's going to talk about and what we're going to do so you'll see where we're headed. Bob Place is going to describe the various exemptive provisions, and you'll see quickly that the Congress littered the Investment Company Act with different ones that say different things for different purposes. They all have findings that have to be made, so Ken is going to talk about the nature of the findings and what you have to actually do to issue an order. I get to describe what happens if you can't issue an order, that is, you can't make the findings, you don't like the application, or even worse, in some respects, you do like the application, but there's been a request for a hearing, or you've decided to set it down for hearing, and all of a sudden, a lot of the division's resources disappear into fighting about a hearing. The fifth group of issues to talk about is what happens, what are the implications to the division, and how it's handled its matters as a result of having exemptive authority. So I'll talk briefly about the effect it's had on no action letters, the effect it's had on the adoption of rules, and what we do when you get unwanted applications. If the benefit of 6C and the other exemptive provisions is that the SEC can do things, the bane, of course, is that any idiot with a 42-cent stamp, can send something in that you actually have to deal with. So there's an aspect of having people whose issues you don't like or the timeliness isn't very apt actually dictate the SEC staff's agenda, which was always a frustration. Bob's going to discuss what happens when there is actually a request for hearing, and we've got, between us, we came up with some damn good examples of the some of the loony things that have happened. And then at the end, we'll wrap up with what I would usually be called in a classroom setting war stories. We're going to go through some of the applications that either resulted in hearings or were controversial and how they ended up becoming rules. And I think if we were speaking only to a group of people who were at law school somewhere in Idaho and you didn't have access to the exemptive orders, you will be surprised at how much of the law about the 40 Act is contained in the things that the division has done down through time by issuing orders and granting people exemptive relief. So that's the premise of the program, and Bob, you get to go first.
Thanks, Marty. I think you're right. Your description of the exemptive program and how important it is to the development law is quite accurate. We don't have to go out and ask people where work needs to be done, where the Act is imposing unnecessary encumbrances on the business, or we could just talk to the people who are reviewing the applications and take a look at the numbers. We have a feedback loop from the industry as to provisions of the statute that provide problems with the development of the industry and a mechanism by which we can shape the statute to fit the future. The way this statute that was adopted so many years ago in 1940 can be relevant to a dynamic marketplace that has changed tremendously since that time in 2008. Now, as Marty mentioned, there are multiple sources of exemptive authority in the statute, but I'm not going, as exciting as it would be to review each one of them, I'm not going to have time to do that, but I am going to break them up into some categories and describe a few highlights of them to give you a feel and perhaps describe some of the issues that result from there being multiple sources of exemptive authority, issues some of which we take advantage today. But in 1940, with this brand new statute, in the early 40s, there were some really head-scratching issues that the staff and the commission had to resolve, and they did resolve. Two types of exemptive authority. One is the broad exemptive authority of 6C of the Act and its counterpart, 206A of the Advisors Act. Second is the specialized exemptive provisions that are embedded within certain provisions of the Act and sometimes essentially overlap with 6C of the Act. The exemptive authority, it's another important thing, implicit in Marty's statement, the exemptive authority provisions typically not only provide the commission with authority to issue orders providing individualized exemptive relief, but provide rulemaking authority, broader rulemaking authority. And yes, the staff does have a process by which we eventually codify the orders, the individual orders, and make them available to a broader set of applicants without the need to actually apply. Of course, the procedures for issuing orders and the procedures for issuing rules are significantly different for rulemaking. We have to go through a public notice and comment process, which is a bit different than the hearing request process we'll talk about in a little while. Now, as I mentioned, the quintessential exemptive provision is 6C of the Investment Company Act. Now, 6C is the model Congress used when it provided the Commission with additional exemptive authority. It's sort of the original exemptive authority provision. The Advisors Act authority, 206A, didn't come along until 1970, and it was modeled after 6C. An exemptive authority the Commission has under the 33 and 34 Acts that were added by NISMIA in 1996, you can see it's much later, they also were modeled under based on Section 6C. So you can see this one provision that was written in 1940 it has had an effect not only within the Investment Company Act, but the other securities laws we administered. Interestingly enough, under the 33 Act, the provision is modified differently. We only have authority under the 33 Act to write exemptive rules, not to do individualized exemptive orders. Now back to 6C. Under 6C, the SEC may conditionally or unconditionally exempt any person, security, or transaction from any rule or provisions of the Act. That's any rule or provision of the Act. Now, there's certain provisions we traditionally don't provide relief for. If you were thinking of coming in for an exemption from, for example, Section 36B or 36A of the statute, which impose fiduciary duties or prohibit fraudulent conduct, you'll likely find some resistance. In addition to Section 24, by the way, which requires you to pay fees to the federal government, you might have some hesitance on the part of the staff. But yet, the basic authority is very broad and encompasses the entire statute. It's got to be necessary or appropriate in the public interest, consistent with the protection of investors, and the purpose is fairly intended by the policy and provisions of the Act. And Ken's going to talk a little bit about that, what that means. But those are conditions. We don't have a carte blanche from the Congress to provide relief based upon any criteria we want. And that's very important for a couple of reasons, one institutionally and the other more constitutionally. An exemptive authority represents essentially a delegation of legislative authority from the Congress to the executive branch of the government. We are part of the executive branch of the government. And based upon some Supreme Court case law, which has accepted congressional delegation of authority, legislative authority, but it's got to be based on some criteria Congress expects the agency to follow. It simply can't delegate its constitutional legislative authority without some sort of guidance. Institutionally, it gives us a basis of saying no when we really don't want to give the authority. Very important if you're in the exemptive authority office. Now, 6C is by far the most important source of exemptive authority in the Act and the source of authority for most of the orders and the rules we issue. Of course, many of the rules and orders we issue have multiple sources of authority because, after all, why choose one if you can choose multiple and give somebody seeking to sue you that much more difficult time of proving that you didn't have the authority, an experience we have unfortunately had fairly frequently in the last few years. Now, go down to the more specific sources of authority in the statute includes Section 17B. It's a very important provision, which provides the Commission with authority to issue orders but not rules permitting affiliated transactions that are otherwise prohibited by Section 17A. Section 6B, which you might have noticed was the one listed in the announcements for this this gathering today, which provides Commission with authority to exempt employee securities companies from any provision or all provisions of the Act. Now, that provision is kind of interesting in difference in 6C because it works together with a rule the Commission adopted, 6B1, to make the exemptive orders automatically issued upon filing of the application. And the Commission can come back and deny the order or can modify the order, but it basically will stay into effect. You have the effect of the order upon filing to the Commission. And that impacts, of course, the criteria we use and the timeliness of our review, since the need to review orders that are in effect are a little bit different from people who are actually waiting for orders. Section 9C, which may not be well known to the 40 Act lawyers, but is really well known to the enforcement bar here at the Commission, permits the Commission to exempt persons from the bad boy provisions of the Act. Now, there's Section 9A, which automatically disqualifies individuals for playing certain roles in an investment company, including being a director, investment advisor, employee, if you having been found to have violated certain provisions of the securities laws, which means if a fund is involved in a settlement of a violation of security law violation, not simply under the 40 Act but the others, that settlement will typically be accompanied by an application for relief from the bad boy provisions in Section 9A. It will be part of the settlement and it will be something the Commission staff is required to deal with on an expedited basis in order to make the settlement work.
Bob, can I make a point about that provision?
Please.
It's worth looking at because in terms of its breadth, it extends far broader than might be intuitively obvious. If the, for example, an affiliate of the investment advisor to a fund is found to have violated any of the bad boy provisions, the automatic disqualification would be triggered. And this just simply doesn't involve SEC enforcement provisions, by the way. It can involve certain injunctions that come out of state court proceedings.
Right. When Elliot Spitzer got his ex parte injunction against Merrill Lynch for the analysts issue a few years ago, we discovered that Merrill Lynch was automatically disqualified from managing mutual funds. That's perhaps a good example.
Yeah, and sometimes the disqualification can come as a surprise, especially, and since it's automatic, it's important that it be acted on fairly quickly, and I think the division and the office that processes those applications is actually deals with those types of situations on an expedited basis in order to avoid unfortunate ramifications.
In the case of Merrill Lynch, it came to a surprise to the judge that issued the ex parte order, if I recall, who then withdrew the order later on.
Bob, isn't this may be a little ahead of the game, but isn't this an example of the kind of order that you might prioritize over
Yes.
most other orders?
Yes. We're essentially forced to because you end up with an orphaned investment company if you don't. And for those of you who wait for orders, sometimes it's because the staff involved in your order is trying to dig somebody out of a ditch that they've dug themselves into.
And just to make this process more interesting, we may touch on delegated authority later on, but the staff does not have delegated authority to issue a permanent order, but does have delegated authority to issue a temporary order. So what will often happen is a temporary order will be issued at the time of the notice of the application so that there's basically no gap between the event that causes the disqualification and the grant of the order.
Right. It's a fire drill, basically, that happens the staff when something like this happens, particularly if it's a large settlement involving multiple participants. Section 10F, which permits the commission to which gives the commission authority to permit funds to buy securities in an affiliated sponsor underwritings. And finally, I'm just going to mention 2A9, which is kind of interesting, which 2A9 section of the Act, it's a definitional section of the Act which contains its own exempta provision. Usually you don't think of a definitional section having such an operative effect, but 2A9 does. It defines the term control and is critical to determining whether a person is or is not an affiliated person for purposes of the affiliated provision prohibitions of the statute. And in doing so, creates a presumption that a non-natural person that owns more than 25% of a securities in a company, voting securities, controls the company, and a person that owns 25% or less does not control the company. And the SEC has the authority to determine that a person does or does not control, notwithstanding the statutory presumptions. There are also sources of exemptive authority not within the statutory provisions, but within rules itself the commission has adopted. And, of course, the best-known provision of that is Rule 17D1. That rule prohibits joint transactions. 17D doesn't itself prohibit it, but gives us authority, the commission authority, and that rule has been on the books since the early 40s, I believe, simply prohibiting joint transactions. But the authorities that unless the commission shall have issued an order permitting a particular joint transaction, setting forth the criteria by which the commission will do that. You're not likely to see rules like that occur in the future, adopt in the future, because that requires the commission to engage. It expands the commission's workforce, and that type of rule was certainly fine in 1943 or 44 when the commission had a few hundred registrants. Today, with the thousands of registrants we do, those types of provisions are less likely. In fact, one exists also in the Advisors Act dealing with the bad boy provisions of the cash solicitation rule, and you're likely to see the staff recommend amendments to that to eliminate the requirement to get involved every time somebody has a problem. Now, one of the interesting issues is the interaction between the general exemptive authorities and the specific provisions, because, you know, under canons of statutory interpretation, narrow would tend to control the specific within a statutory framework. And so it leads to part of what's an enduring question of the commission and things we'll talk about as we go on. What's the scope of the commission's authority to exempt? What limitations do we have? And again, we're going to focus on how the broad, narrow limitations affect the broad ones. To what extent, for example, again, if, for give you an example, Section 17B of the Investment Company Act allows us to issue orders permit affiliated transactions, but it doesn't speak of rules. To what extent could the commission use 6C to provide an exemptive authority? Other provisions give similar authority, but give narrower criteria in 6C and require and are limited to specific sex effects or specific criteria, which may not be known in a general sense. The commission, very early on in 1948, in a decision called Transit Investment Corporation, gave the commission view, said that it viewed 6C as giving it broad authority to grant exemptive relief and not limited by the conditions as long of the other sections. As long as you met the conditions of 6C, it would seek to give orders. So now what you do have a series of rules using 6C authority granting exemptions for affiliated transactions, even though Section 17B, for example, is the case is not. Another example is a question that has come up is whether the commission's ability to impose conditions, remember this is conditional or unconditional relief, is limited by some of the substantive provisions of the Act. I'll give you an example. Section 10A of the Act requires funds to have boards that consist of at least 40% of independent directors. Could the commission require a fund to have 75%, for example, a majority, as a condition to having just a random example as a condition for using, for example, 12B1, to have a 12B1 plan of the effect. Well, finally, after 65 years of the statute in 2005, a court addressed this in the Chamber of Commerce decision in which it said, of course, there's nothing inconsistent with a 40% requirement by the statute imposing a 75% requirement, given the fact that the statute itself suggests a concern with governance issues. So there's a couple of examples that have come up over the years that are historical in nature, but really do contribute to the nature and the scope of the authority we have today.
Okay, Ken, tell us about the findings.
Well, as Bob said, let's focus on Section 6E for initially, because that's where you generally look for the source of authority. The findings that the Commission has to make is that the grant of the exemption will be, to the extent necessary or appropriate for the public interest, consistent with the protection of investors, and the purposes fairly intended by the policy and provisions of the Act. And these standards have generally been interpreted in a very flexible fashion by the Commission and the staff. But applications are generally built around those conditions and providing the factual basis and generally the conditions under which the Commission can, or the staff under delegated authority, can make the requisite findings. Applications generally contain conditions that are designed to demonstrate that the investors in the fund, if we're talking about that type of exempted application, will be protected. Often those applications will appear to be procedural in nature. For example, in the affiliated transaction area, the orders and the rules generally will provide for review of the transaction.
Choice. Unfortunately, if you can't resolve it, and if the applicant's absolutely determined to go forward, and the division can't support it, and you can't make them back off, then it's set down for a hearing before an administrative law judge. The administrative law judge is an administrative form. It has rules under the rules of practice. The division is a party, and we'll talk about this more later, and the applicant's a party. I'm assuming that no one else has requested a hearing, so it's just the applicant fighting with the division. I submit that that's really a lousy way to do public policy. The administrative law judges, most of their business is trying enforcement cases, not trying to figure out whether something is or isn't appropriate for exemptive relief. And having them as a matter of process be involved in what I would regard as making policy decisions traditionally has not worked out very well. One of the other problems is because it's now in an administrative proceeding, the Commission itself has shifted the hat it's wearing. Instead of wearing its supporting hat as your boss, so you can go talk to the chairman and say, these guys are really causing us a lot of trouble, I don't like this application, you're stuck. You're a party in a proceeding, and so the ex parte rules mean that you can't talk to the Commission at all other than with a piece of paper that you've served on the other side. And it's very hard, I think, to put the Commission in a position where the division that they want most of their policy advice from is incapable of talking to them other than in writing and in a formal way. And somebody like the old Opinions and Review Group in General Counsel ends up having to figure out what the division would have done had they had the opportunity to talk, which I'll explain later when we talk about some of the specific examples, how we creatively got around the ex parte rules. But it is painful to not be able to talk to your boss about something that's important to them.
But okay. This process does not happen
very often.
I was going to ask if it ever happens.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Yes. But it's been quite a while.
Okay, so let's look at the other side. For whatever set of reasons, Ken was able to reach all the conclusions, and he was perfectly happy. And so using delegated authority, he or the associate director and his group signed the order, the secretary issued it, and away it goes. And the consequence of the order is really pretty profound. Whatever the transaction is that's covered by the order, the applicant is now protected as against the world on that. No one can say anything about its status under Section 17 because they weren't a party to the application. They didn't put in a request for a hearing on the application. It's really the gold seal of approval. And as compared to example for what we all casually call no action letters, or a phrase that I hate, granting no action or relief, which makes it sound like some sort of regal thing you do with a wand, because all you're doing actually is issuing a letter.
There is a regal quality to it.
I know. But it really is substantially different. No one can defend against it. Okay, so what happens if an applicant gets an order and then his business facts change? Well, then he just abandons relying on the order, and he does, I mean, assuming he's not violating the law, he goes off and does whatever he does, and he doesn't have to come back and have it removed or expunged. It's also entirely possible that if this, for example, was an amortized cost order from the early 1980s, by the time 1985 comes around, Bob Plays has adopted Rule 2A7, and 2A7 now is a better deal than they got from the exemptive process. They can rely on the rule and abandon their order, and that's fine, too. I can't think of a particular circumstance where it's happened in this agency. It's happened in other agencies where the applicant applies. It happened to the Federal Reserve Board several times where the applicant applies. The Federal Reserve Board granted the application, but not the application the applicant wanted. They granted something else. And so the applicant, I'm serious, it was non-bank banks, and they appealed to every circuit court in the land and ended up in the Supreme Court. So if you do have a finding that's adverse to you when you get an order you don't like, it is possible to go to a circuit court of appeals. Okay, so the next part of this, Bob and I are going to do sort of back and forth to try and tease out, so what's this mean to the division? If you've got this huge grant of authority, think of it as a tool, what effect does it have on your life when you're thinking about using other tools? And my personal, I'll start with the no action letters and then you can chime in. One of the things that always was very attractive, if you had a no action letter that you were trying to work through and they were asking for something that you were generally sympathetic with, but the words of the statute just couldn't get you there, or you had to, the word bank had to mean insurance company, or you had to pretend that a bank doesn't own securities, so it's not within Section 3 in any respect, or something else that is very hard for you to do, but you're generally sympathetic with what they're going to do. The big advantage this division's always had is you can still find a way to say yes. You say, I can't sign a no action letter, I won't do that, but I am absolutely sympathetic to the idea of foreign banks, foreign insurance companies selling commercial paper in the United States. So if you file an application, we will support it. And, of course, that's exactly what happened. And the alternative in the case of the foreign banks was to have to say that everything they held wasn't a security, that they weren't in the business of investing in securities, which would have caused us to have to take the position that mortgages, commercial loans, all sorts of things that were normal for a European bank wouldn't work.
And so one of the tensions within the division is what can be done by no action letter, right, and what can be done, what requires an exemptive order, and what are the advantages of both positions, both to the applicant but also to the division. A no action letter creates precedent, although we all know it's not officially precedent, but it's relied on by everyone. An order, of course, is granted only to the individuals. In some cases, people want relief. We might think it might be relief worthwhile, but it is inconsistent with a body of no action letters that, if we were to change, wouldn't simply affect the transaction, could affect a range of other transactions and how we analyze those transactions. We're more likely to push somebody over to do an exemptive order in that case.
My only observation, and this is not meant as criticism, but sometimes working through those issues can take a significant amount of time.
Yes. Well, they're very difficult because you're talking, first of all, institutionally, you're talking about two different offices.
Yes.
Within the agency. And you're talking about division directors who have changed over the time, who have different views and different values. Finally, I must tell you that no action process is a lot less resource intensive than the exemptive order process and timing, and that's a consideration that enters into it also.
If we're in the outside looking in, one of the problems is often that you can't tell what it is that's causing the hesitancy about doing what. And it could also be that in addition to internal 40 Act considerations, there's an aspect of this that involves corp fin, and it's a word that shows up in your statute and a word that shows up in their statute, and you have to be sensitive that you haven't done something that will adversely affect their administration of their statute. And all of that, from the applicant standpoint or the outsider standpoint, is happening kind of behind the screen. It's not very often that you actually get to be involved in those discussions.
And very similar to what the IRS or Treasury goes through on tax matters, you may have a perfectly good argument, but what you're not aware of behind the screen, the argument you're making has some implications in some completely disconnected area of tax law, and they simply can't do it.
One other consideration, and this goes to basically how sometimes orders become rules, is that it's been a long pattern in the division, which I personally think has been healthy and good, is to try something. I don't want to call it an experiment, but do the first ETF order or do the first amortized cost order and then see what happens and use the other resources of the commission to pay attention. So this isn't pretend. We really did do the first amortized cost orders and then went right out and inspected people to see what they were doing, to see if it was going to work. And that way you get your feet wet. You can actually have an experience and then learn from it. Among other things, in terms of managing the division's workload, if it turns out that everybody wants a money market fund or multiple money market funds, you could end up with a couple thousand applications to do what's now in Rule 2A7, and that's just an unreasonable workload for the division. So over time, during different administrations, different division directors, different chairmen, there's always been a focus on trying to find a pattern of applications and then turn them into a rule, which basically outsources the legal work right back to the law firms to comply. 3A5, 3A6, 3A7, 3A8 are all examples of finding a way to get it out of the commission's workload and move it on to others. The last thing that's on my list, and then you can comment too, is what I said before is true. The stamp size was different in different days, but it's a 42-cent stamp now, and anybody can put it on an envelope, address it to the SEC, and it'll end up on somebody's desk. And the people who ask questions aren't necessarily asking questions you would like to answer. We had more trouble than we could live with in the 70s when the very first people who started out with money market funds were using the amortized cost assumption in the accounting rules that if you held something for 60 days or less that you could hold it at its original purchase price. There were others who wanted to hold things that had a longer maturity than that, and it didn't seem right from a business standpoint to stop that. But we also had a commission, all five of them, who were absolutely opposed to the idea of giving up on anything that would look like a stable net asset value. So you also have bosses, and if the boss says we're not going to have a stable net asset value, everybody has to mark to market. That's the heart of Section 2A41. Then you end up sort of going nowhere. In that case, it was Federated, who filed an application. We felt compelled to move on it, and over 3 years, Federated and the others who filed dictated exactly what half the division did. We worked on an we worked on an amortized cost hearing that was painful because we had to do it in front of an ALJ instead of in front of the commission. Okay, request for a hearing.
Yes, the process is that an application is submitted. The staff or the commission, depending upon whether we can do it for delegated authority, notices the hearing, meaning publishes a notice in the Federal Register, or more likely you're going to be reading it on our website now in the future. And interested parties have an opportunity to request a hearing, which means a hearing before the commission, to oppose the application or the terms under which the staff proposes to recommend an exemptive application. And that presents an interesting set of procedures. And, of course, in Marty's lingo, any idiot can file a 43-cent stamp and stop an exemptive application. First, it's necessary for two of the largest banks in the world to merge because they have a 40 Act issue with respect to a unit investment trust that needs relief for foreign custody services. And, in fact, we have had people over the years do file those requests. And under SEC rule, now it's not part of the statute, we limit require hearings to be by interested persons and to raise certain material facts for the commission. Now, the interested person is the one that I'm particularly interested in. Marty, you could talk about the reasonable questions before the commission. it's part of a rule, and it's designed to protect the commission's processes. It's designed to prevent the commission's hearing process or application process used to fight other battles and to assure ourselves that the people who are contesting an application have a legitimate interest for that hearing. So generally an interested person, the commission has stated that to be an interested person entitled to request, a requester must state an ownership or other direct interest in the applicants at issue, or demonstrate that it is likely to be harmed by the granting of an application. And this is the equivalent of the commission's the standing provisions in federal court. We want to protect our processes. I think the better examples of this one is a dispute between S&P and Vanguard just a few years ago. Vanguard had an exemptive application before the staff requesting an amendment in order to establish an ETF that was going to be a series of an open-end fund. ETF was embroiled in a dispute at the time with McGraw-Hill that owned the S&P license over various matters associated with that license, and sought to intervene in the ETF applications by claiming that it would be against the public interest if we were to issue the exemptive order, because after all, their licenses were being breached by Vanguard. And the staff, after seeking guidance from the commission, denied their request for hearing relief because we believed that essentially the questions that were going to be argued in front of the commission were essentially questions of licensing law and not the underlying 40 Act issues presented by the application. A similar one was the chemical bank merger with
It's either Chase or Manhattan.
Chase Manhattan Bank, in which Matthew Lee, who was a local activist in New York that was interested in community lending, objected to an exemptive order under Section 26 for a unit investment trust to have foreign custody. And he claimed, not personally, but for an organization whose members of which may have checking accounts at these banks or may own unit investment trusts. And the staff there developed a standing with respect to membership organizations that looks very much like the standing obligations, standing requirements that the D.C. Circuit uses to screen out individuals. So we do get hearing requests. We're very much interested in making sure that those are serious hearing requests with serious issues at stake. And we have the ability to deny hearing requests for those that the staff and the commission concludes aren't.
Can I interrupt just a second? I was involved in one also with an ETF where Fund Democracy sought to intervene and request a hearing for the first Barclays iShares. And what happened in that case, I believe, was that Mercer ultimately withdrew his application, so you never had to reach the question of whether he had standing or not.
Right.
And the withdrawal was based on Barclays' willingness to expand disclosure in the prospectus, which is what he was after anyway.
Very much. And when we're codifying the ETF orders, we have this settlement that has become a standard part of exemptive application, a settlement that which we weren't a party to at all. And now the question back to the staff is, do we incorporate the terms of that settlement into the rule?
The one point I'd just like to make in connection with the staff's dealing with interventions, as Bob said, the staff doesn't have delegated authority to decline a hearing. It has to go to the commission. So that will add time to the process. But the other point is that, particularly in the bank merger situation, it really illustrates the ability of the staff and the commission to turn around something relating to an application if and give it expedited treatment if there are real time constraints and you can demonstrate that in issuing the order. There you had a merger that I think was scheduled to close the week following the filing of the intervention. There have been other situations where there are real-time constraints on transactions that have really nothing to do with the Investment Company Act, but for some reason an exemptive order will be necessary to deal with one aspect of the transaction, and the staff has generally been extremely responsive to giving those expedited treatment or triaging them in a way that gets them done in time for people's business objectives to be met.
My interested person story is representing Stanford in requesting a hearing on Tia Kreft's exempt application in the summer of 1987. Obviously, Stanford didn't own a single one of the annuities that TIAA-CREF was holding. They were all held by on behalf of Stanford, was submitting money on behalf of Stanford professors and employees. And we argued for standing because it was our employees whose money was in the contracts. It was our money as the employer that was going into the contracts. And we objected to the fact that at the time TIAA-CREF had no ability to provide any kind of redemption, and any other kind of annuity we paid money into on behalf of our employees did. There was a hearing, and at that we ended up with the zooiest one of ever. There at one point there were over 29 interveners. So those of us who had real clients went out to lunch with those who had more obstreperous clients. And everybody got a minder, and we managed to get the oral arguments down to one day instead of everyone making a full one-hour pitch on behalf of himself. I was also the recipient of the best reasonable question. There was a person who's since died who routinely filed an exemptive final protest over anything that IDS and Allegheny did. So throughout the late 60s and early 70s, he was constantly asking for hearings. And it was your point. It had nothing to do with what was going on. So the law firm that was representing IDS called me the day that we would have issued the order by delegated authority and said, you're going to get a request for a hearing. We've just gotten it here in New York. So I raced around and made sure the secretary didn't issue it. You know, the last thing you want to do when you know you've got one coming in the mail is issue it and then have to do something with it. So I waited a couple days, and it finally showed up. Sure as hell, he'd sent it snail mail, so there was no way we were going to get it on time. So it was delinquent, but it was also bad. So the law firm was kind enough to send me a series of cases in which he'd appeared from New York State, in one of which the New York State Supreme Court, whatever the most senior court is in New York, had decided that he was the kind of pernicious plaintiff that should never be allowed to file a complaint anywhere, and had referred him to the New York State Bar Association and asked for them to disbar him. And they had, so he was appearing pro se minus his license. When we finally got through denying it, there's a request for a hearing. He then sued IDS, the SEC, and me for violating his First Amendment rights. So for a while, I was actually represented by a very lovely New York lawyer who's famous for representing people in First Amendment cases. The last thing on the list is venue, and of course, the example is Vanguard. They're unique, so of course, we had to get a 17D application from them in the early 70s. Most of the 70s were spent processing it. It went to at least two hearings. Arthur Brown lived for several months in several years in Philadelphia, and the ALJ did too. And boy, did we learn from that. Venue is now determined in the rules of practice so that the venue of all hearings, absent anything else, is here. Then at least we all slept at home because we didn't have a travel budget for things like that. Well, I think we're down to my outline, Roman 6, so this is story time. We've divided up the examples of things that where exemptive relief was important and later became something else. Kathleen, why don't you start with ETFs?
Well, it hasn't become something else yet, but we're in the process of the rulemaking procedure that Bob was talking about earlier because the first ETF order was granted in 1993, and the rule proposal to codify the applications was proposed in March of this year, and comments are still coming in, I believe. So the next phase of the procedure will be that Bob and his team will be looking at the comments and whatever else they feel the need to look at, and then either propose a rule for final effectiveness or modify or repropose or whatever. And Bob, I don't know whether you want to comment
well,
on how that...
Well, for those of you in the audience or watching, I read the comments, and I think they're the highest quality set of comments I've ever read on a rulemaking, and they're going to be very useful to us in moving forward.
I've been encouraging everybody to weigh in because this is their opportunity to do so. So in any event, so we haven't gotten there yet, but I should point out that I'm the only one on the panel who has never worked on the staff, so I'm an outsider and have worked with the staff a very long time and have had, from my perspective anyway, a wonderful relationship. And in fact, I'm sort of spoiled because not long ago, I was working with Corp Fin on something else, and I was having a battle with someone, and we were going back and forth, and finally the Corp Fin person said, well, you know, you're just spoiled because the IM people actually have to think about these things and, you know, make a determination because they have exemptive authority, but we don't have that, so we can just say no, which is what they did. And I began to think about it and realize what's been said here is absolutely true. And in fact, the discussion about whether something should be an exemptive order or processed as an exemptive order or as a no-action letter is really true. And sometimes I've had it the reverse way around, where for whatever reason we've convinced ourselves that the only way we can solve this problem is an order, and somebody on staff may say, you know, let's think about no-action and let's kick it around. Maybe we can do that. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But there's a flexibility on the staff to try to figure out a way to get the applicant the relief they need if it's a legitimate request is a very strong aspect of the staff, and in my experience has led to, I think, their point of thinking to be more flexible and more creative. And certainly that was the case in the ETF situation. I'm sure, much like what Marty went through, the creature itself is completely at odds with the statute. It's a hybrid, basically, of an open-end and a closed-end fund. And when it was proposed, actually the history of it is very interesting. Nate Most, who was the Amex at the time, wanted to have a mutual fund that traded on the stock exchange. So he went to John Bogle and he said, why don't we list Vanguard? And John Bogle had a bunch of issues, including the fact that he felt that the people selling in and out would really disrupt the whole portfolio management aspect, which then led Nate to go back to the drawing board and think more like a custodial receipt or a basket trade, where you would put the stocks in there and then you would trade, you know, odd lots on an exchange, and you would redeem or issue huge lots at NAV using the underlying securities. So this really turned out to be a hybrid structure. And I think the first presentation was made, I was not involved in the very first presentation, I think it was made in like 1989 maybe. And then it worked its way through and there were lots and lots of meetings and discussions. But the staff was very encouraging, and we ultimately got the relief in 93. But as an example of Marty talking about letting people speak get wet, there was no future relief in that application. It was simply for the Spider Trust, and the thought was we would see how that worked out. And then subsequent ones, again, were specific. The mid-cap spiders, diamonds, webs, country baskets, they were all specific without future relief. And it was really Barclays that, when they filed in 2001, when we got relief for future. And since then, of course, they've all morphed into all kinds of things. We now have ETFs that hold foreign securities, specialize in sectors, or they do a whole host of things. The most interesting one, kind of the Chinese word interesting, it took 7 years, was the ProFunds application, which involved not only regular ETFs, but involved leverage, inverse and inverse leveraged funds. And a great deal of that time taken up with the application was interfacing with Market Reg, because Market Reg had a whole host of issues about leverage and derivatives and a listed product that intersected with how the application worked. So for a long time, there were joint conferences with Market Reg and IM, and, you know, trying to please one side of the table or the other, if you will, and it finally came to fruition. So the experience has been a wonderful one for me. The applicants probably would hate to hear me say that, because it's a time-consuming process. It's gotten much faster than what it had been, and also there are very few funds that are like pro funds that are so complicated that we have a seven-year situation. But ultimately, it's led to the rule proposal, and I think everybody is looking very much forward to, you know, getting a rule that will at least cover a lot of what people do now, and to some degree, more of a forward-looking rule, because it also covers the active transparent applications, which have only just started to be released. So that the staff is trying to look ahead and permit a wider scope than just the traditional, if you will, ETFs. And I think that will be a great thing for all sides.
This is a perfectly good example. When we took up the rulemaking, most of the heavy lifting had been done. And we had a track record, we had had examinations, we had data in terms of how these ETFs had traded, and a very good groundwork had been done. And most of the groundwork, much of it, of course, from the industry. And this is just an example. In the 1992 Protecting Investors study, we identified an anomaly in which there were open-end funds and there were closed-end funds, and ne'er the twain shall meet, and that these closed-end funds were trading at a discount. And this was a problem, and we needed to develop some sort of hybrid. And the staff came up with a hybrid we called an interval fund and did rulemaking. This did not come up through the exemptive roof. Rather, this was a financial vehicle essentially created by the commission staff. I think you can count the number of ones that are out there on one or two hands right now that didn't come off. Give you an example is an ETF which addresses the same, and by my personal opinion, I speak only for myself, is that an interval fund has the worst features of open-end funds and closed-end funds combined. Whereas the ETF, which came up with the industry, and a lot of very smart people who understand finance, is also a hybrid between an open-end fund and closed-end fund, but in my view, just watching it these years, has the best characteristics of both open-end funds and closed-end funds for the perspective of an investor. And it's something which without which this the exemptive process by which the ideas, the financial ideas, and the thoughts, the creativity of the private sector can come in, and we can adapt the statute and consistent with the values of that statute to meet the investment needs of the statute, you can see how much more successful we've been when we use that model, when we try to use a different model in terms of come up with a solution to the problem on ourselves. I think it's a lesson of government humility in some respects.
Okay. One area we really haven't touched on, and an area I actually find among the most interesting, is the way in which the division deals with status questions, the existential question of whether a company is or isn't an investment company. And those types of issues come up in a number of different ways. As Marty alluded to earlier, for example, U.S. banks and U.S. insurance companies, which based on their asset composition almost certainly would be investment companies, are specifically accepted from the definition by the statute. The statute did not accept foreign banks or foreign insurance companies. So the staff, initially through a series of orders, gradually got comfortable with letting foreign banks issue commercial paper and other debt instruments, and ultimately adopted a definitional rule that accepted foreign banks and foreign insurance companies that met certain conditions from regulation of the Act. The way that evolved is actually very interesting. Initially, the staff proceeded under Section 6E, which basically allows the commission to give exemptions to investment companies or other people. And it didn't really address the fundamental question of whether foreign banks or foreign insurance companies were investment companies. The rule that was ultimately adopted, or the rule that's in place now, the rule actually evolved over time, basically said they're not investment companies. And that has a number of important implications for dealing with other issues. There also there's a provision in the statute, Section 3B2, that basically provides the commission with the authority to declare certain companies that, based on an asset composition test that was adopted in 1940, to declare that based on a number of factors, those companies are not investment companies based on their primary business. And the primary business test, in turn, was developed in a commission decision known as Tonopah Mining. And there actually is a Tonopah, Nevada, where 40 Act lawyers, if they're driving across the Southwest, will stop and have their picture taken.
We actually have an associate who lived in Tonopah, and he's bought shares in the Tonopah Mining Company, and he has them on his wall.
Yeah, yeah. I gave some to an ex-40 Act person as a present one day.
The Tonopah standard basically looks at five factors, including what generally probably continues to be thought of as the two most important, the composition of the issuer's assets and the sources of their income. There was recently a Seventh Circuit decision, I guess a year ago, written by Judge Easterbrook, where basically he applied the Tonopah factors to a salad shooter manufacturing company, which is interesting reading. Because he seemed to suggest that the last two factors aren't actually the most important factors. I don't know if that's had any impact on the way the staff has evaluated the applications. But basically what will happen is a company that has basically is an investment company under this asset composition test will come in and basically in their application explain their business and explain why they're not an investment company. And the based on the Tonopah factors, the staff will, you know, on the right set of facts, declare that they're not. These are interesting applications because it kind of gives the division bleacher seats, if you will, on what might be happening in the rest of the economy outside of the investment management business. Among the more interesting series of applications I worked on came in 1999 or 2000 as the internet boom was taking off. There were a number of companies that characterized themselves as internet incubator companies that for a number of reasons didn't fall into a rule 3A1, which had codified the commission's various exemptive orders under 3B2. And they basically had to come in a couple cases did, demonstrate that notwithstanding the fact that they had some, I think, income issues, they were not investment companies, and they received orders. So these can be very interesting orders in the sense that it gives the division some sense of what's going on in the internet incubator industry, in the telecommunications industry. If you go back to the 1940s, it would have been the mining industry.
It's fun to work in this area. you're as a practitioner, your choice is always whether you feel compelled to file a Section 3B2 application or based on what Easterbrook has said and what the litigated cases say, whether you can write an opinion under Section 3B1 that will be commercially acceptable. In this area, it's very hard to write flat opinions. You end up writing something that we would call discursive and reasoned, and that ends up, when you've had to write 25 pages explaining why they aren't an investment company, the underwriter type stopped reading, like at the second page, and that's just, for their purposes, commercially unacceptable. Going back to something we talked about earlier, I'm unfortunately also the first person that ever filed an application on behalf of shareholders of Idealab, the nice company that you gave the order to, asking for the 3B2 to be withdrawn because it had, I alleged, been based on a false representation of the facts. They settled their litigation my application was withdrawn. You didn't have to take it to a hearing.
The other area where this comes up, which is also important to practitioners outside of the 40 Act, are a number of different types of corporate financing vehicles that, again, definitionally, at least in the Commission's view, appear to be investment companies, like, for example, financing subsidiaries that corporations set up to issue debt or preferred stock and that then on loan the proceeds from those financings to the various affiliated companies. Are they or are they not investment companies? It usually depends on your view as to whether intercompany debt would be viewed as a security for this purpose. The rule 3A5, an exemptive rule, is premised on a conclusion that it would be. So if you're involved in that type of financing, you need to become familiar with rule 3A5. Similarly, Rule 3A7 is a rule that allows a lot of securitizations and asset-backed securities to proceed without being regulated as investment companies. That rule was developed in an exhaustive process, which included, I think, probably the longest chapter of the 1992 study, followed by a rule proposal. And again, that is the rule that has permitted credit card securitizations, auto loan credit card securitizations at least, to proceed without having to deal with the Investment Company Act. So these status issues don't have, actually their primary impact isn't necessarily on the investment company bar or the investment company industry. It really illustrates how the Act can have an impact on operating companies.
So if this was the first day of class, what I would say to you is you need to pay attention, because no matter what kind of corporate lawyer you turn out to be when you grow up, every single transaction you touch, every commercial loan, every IPO, every securitization, everything is going to have in it somewhere a rep and a warranty that says, I am not now and I am not required to be registered under the Investment Company Act. And then you have to explain what Section 47B means. And we changed it in 1980 so to follow the Louis Loss ALI code model, so that it says that any transaction or any contract done in violation of the Investment Company Act is voidable. And when you explain to commercial people, that means that if ID Lab doesn't actually know what it is, and you do a public offering, and somebody sues, you get to give all the proceeds back. They insist on very clear answers. So you'll be employed forever.
You know, it strikes me, one thing that's probably obvious but that we haven't mentioned is that in addition to the Act being dynamic because of the order process, all of our clients' businesses are dynamic. And they often forget, if they're operating pursuant to an order, that they have to keep thinking about the order as they progress to make sure that whatever it is they're doing continues to be something that was permitted by order.
Right, absolutely, because one of our standard exam procedures when we do an exam is to look at the orders that the fund has received and see if they are complying with the terms of that order, and it is not uncommon that people have forgotten about certain orders.
Although the other thing that did happen to us, I'm sorry to say, in the 70s was to discover that we'd given people status exemptions that had conditions in them that had to be met, and we had them, they were supposed to report to us, we were supposed to pay attention, and of course we failed to do it. So I think by the early 1980s, we'd stop putting anything in an order. If we gave you an order that said you could go away, you went away forever, we had no more responsibility for you whatsoever, because we didn't do a very good job of keeping track of people that we'd given partial relief to.
Right, and that's an issue, because we don't have authority to examine people who are determined not to be investment companies. So, and to simply receive these passive reports, we'd have to establish. In many some respects, this exemptive process was established in a lot of the orders and requirements and reports for a much smaller industry than we have today, and that's a factor of it. I'd like to move on to perhaps the last topic we have today, which is, I think, one of my favorite ones, and has a rich and colorful history. Ken spoke to it briefly, but I'd like to talk to you about it more specifically, which is the fund of funds provisions. It shows that these exemptive orders and the serves of exemptive orders not only lead to rules, but sometimes they actually lead to statutory changes, and then this is one that's been. Now, 12D1 it prohibits fund of funds, and it's designed to prevent pyramiding arrangements by which one financier, for example, can use an investment company to buy shares of another company and acquire control of those investment companies, and through use of a fairly small amount of money, control a pyramid of investment companies, a large amount of assets, which that control can be then used for a number of nefarious things, including, for example, looting the investment companies. And so this was original part of the 1940 Act, and it was tightened considerably in 1970 in response to the exploits of Bernie Kornfeld and his fund of funds exploits.
Okay,
Marty,
so I can't
tell great stories.
I can't resist. Okay, so by 1972 or 73, they'd finally published a book about him. What he did was have the fund that he controlled buy other funds, and then he paid himself the sales load for the privilege of having invested in the other fund, as well as, of course, having dual levels of fees. And his sales mantra was, "Do you sincerely want to be rich?" That's what he was telling his salesman. And there was a period of time in the 70s and 80s where we'd get people coming from the Philippines or from South America, and would be the Ministry of Finance, and we'd always be meeting with them on the SEC staff, and we'd always say, so where's your mutual fund industry? Where does savings go? And they'd go, oh, no, Bernie Kornfeld came here. No mutual funds. No mutual funds. No mutual funds. So, but the end of this, of course, is that Bernie Kornfeld recently died, and as only
– that was Robert Vesco, who
no,
is
no. Kornfeld died like 3 years ago, but there were two obits. It was classic. The New York Times obit. Bernie Kornfeld, famous financier, lives in Switzerland, and he described the last nitwit scheme he had that was supposed to raise money. And then it goes down to lived with beautiful women, blah, 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 goes on here. The Washington Post is exactly the other way. Bernie Kornfeld. And, of course, the last woman he lived with was the Hollywood madam. So they've got a hit in the obit. They've got a hit when you read it online of how you could go to see all the people she's slept with. It was just classic.
Anyways, I told you this is a story with a rich history, and I'm sure many people have been drawn to 40 Act law just in order to deal with these issues. But the section, back to business for a moment, the section limits the amount of one shares of one fund another fund can buy. It basically says you can only invest, you can't invest more than 3% of your asset shares in any one fund, and any more than 5% of you can't buy more than 5% of another fund. And it limits an overall basket to 10%, no more than 10% of your shares. Now, the first orders we issued, and very few, in 1982 to allow cash sweeps, and this was, I believe, Frank Russell, by which a fund takes its cash instead of managing it itself, it invests it in a money market fund. It's a more efficient way. A lot of conditions, a limited amount of money, very, very tight, very limited exemptive order. And then in 1983, Vanguard approached the staff and wanted to simply wipe out, I guess from staff view, the whole provisions. It wanted to set up a scheme by which a Vanguard fund would invest in solely other Vanguard funds. It wouldn't violate one of these provisions, the 3%, 5%, or 2%. It wouldn't violate all three of them simultaneously, provisions. But Vanguard's argument was that investors would benefit this because they would be getting asset allocation services for this. And after all, the fund on top, the top-level fund, was not going to be charging separate fees, although it would be paying an additional level of 24F2 fees to the commission. But Vanguard, and Ken alluded to that, raised fundamental issues in terms of how we approach 6C and the breadth of our authority to do this based upon notions of public policy and how that interacted with the provision of 6C dealing with the policies and purposes of the statute. How do you define a policy and purpose of the statute? And since Congress had revisited this area just a few years hence, ought the commission to be doing wholesale violence, is some thought, to the statute. And there was a debate within the staff. And you could see a debate ultimately within the commission, for it was a 3-2 vote that it was ultimately approved with the dissent that Ken discussed. In 1989, a few years later, the commission unanimously gave similar relief to T. Rowe Price, although we did extract a couple of more conditions at the time. 1996 is where things really got interesting. There was a conference, remember Ken, mutual funds conference, mm-hmm. where a leading member of Congress, I believe at that time the chairman of the subcommittee dealing with securities, announced that he was going to do mutual fund legislation and he was going to do fund-to-funds.
It was the one thing that he identified that was broken.
Broken.
It absolutely needed to be fixed.
And since we'd given the relief, and since nobody else was asking for the relief, and we had no applications pending, Ken and I, together with Barry Barbash, who was director at the time, sat around his office the Monday morning after reading about the speech, wondering exactly what did Congressman Fields have in mind. Well, it turns out that I'm not sure Congressman Fields had anything particular in mind, as far as we could tell. But our idea hatched about that time was, well, why don't we draft some legislation that would codify the Vanguard and the T. Rowe Price orders? And, Ken, I believe you did that.
We codified those orders. And I think out of recognition that these products were likely to develop beyond those orders and in an effort to save the commission a debate similar
yes.
to what they had in connection with the Vanguard application, we inserted an additional exemptive provision in 12D that basically focuses on the public on the interests of investors, dropping the provision relating to the policies and provisions of the Act on the theory that omission coupled with some legislative history
that said we should use the authority in a progressive way.
Right. Yes, and that's how you, if you can't change the words in the statute, you go talk to the House staff and you help them write the legislative history. And that's why you were told to have it done in a progressive way.
So,
right off my word processor.
As a result of this, the amendments to the 12D1, the legislative history, That we have now issued not only more exemptive orders in this area, but have done a considerable amount of rulemaking in the last years. First of all was the codification of Vanguard and the STAR orders meant that these internal fund funds within the same complex could be done without exemptive relief. So that eliminated a need to do some orders as these things increased. But second, there was implied in this is that we should consider affiliated fund of funds under certain circumstances, and Charles Schwab, I believe, got the first order, although it no longer has an unaffiliated fund of funds.
What?
Unaffiliated funds of funds on terms that would prevent that the problems with the Bernie Kornfield and the old ones. And key, Ken, to that exemptive order, Ken, which I think is you developed your time here at the Commission, was the idea that there would be an agreement between the investing and the investee fund, which would allow the fund to prevent itself to control the amount of investment coming into the fund and how they were treated.
Lest you think that everything that goes in the 40 Act was thoughtful and done well, it is clear and you can absolutely figure out the public policy. Section 12 is the very best for explaining what Metternich or Bismarck said, that when you deal with legislation, you should just appreciate the result. It's, remember, the analogy is sausage. You should just enjoy what you eat, forget about how they did it. And my personal favorite is Section 12D1F.
Yes.
Representative Claude Pepper had a person in his district named Milton Mound. Milton Mound had an ugly little fund of funds business where he charged a 1.5% load, but he promised not to own more than 3% of anybody else's fund. And he begged Claude Pepper to make sure he could continue to sell this terrible product to all of the old people in his district in Florida. And Claude Pepper bought it, and so you've got 12D1F sitting in there with absolutely nothing, none of the investor protections he just talked about, the double feeing, anything else. It's just the sales load, no more than 3%. There are weird things.
Anyways, we have recently, in the last couple of years, used this authority to codify the cash sweep orders, which, remember, the first one given in 1982, and recently proposed, Kathy, along with the ETF rules, was a rule allowing funds to invest in ETFs on a basis much more relaxed, more liberal than the Schwab orders would allow, and would permit them to do that without seeking relief from the Commission. It's very common for mutual funds these days to use ETFs to seek exposure or to hedge positions using ETF. They never thought of it as they hardly think of them as investment companies. They're traded on a secondary market. And recently a sweep by OC discovered that there was a common violation. People simply didn't think of ETFs as investment companies. They were bought on an exchange, codified that relief, proposed to codify that relief, and that's pending currently.
Well, we've come to the end of the line. Thank you all for being here. Kathleen, Bob, Ken, thank you for participating in this. I hope we've proved both the first and the secondary premises that the exemptive authority is unique. It has made being in the division a unique experience, and it's a unique part of the Commission's history. For the audience both here at the SEC and listening online at www.sechistorical.org, this program is now permanently preserved in the virtual museum and archive in audio format, and you can listen to our discussion again at any time. A podcast version will be available next month, and a transcript of our discussion will be in the museum later this year. I would like to invite all here in the auditorium and within the SEC building to join us now in the foyer for the Ice Cream Social to celebrate the 74th birthday of the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Thank you for being here today.